Om Namo Shivaya. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 14, entitled Brahma's Prayers to Lord Krishna. This is text number 23. Repeat after me. Ekastvam Atma Purusha Purana Satya Swayam Jyotir Ananta Adhya Nityo Shara Jasra Sukho Sukho Niranjana Purana Davyo Mukta Upadita Mrittaha. Translation. You are the one supreme soul, the primeval supreme personality, the absolute truth, self-manifested, endless and beginningless. You are eternal and infallible, perfect and complete, without any rival and free from all material designations. Your happiness can never be obstructed, nor have you any connection with material contamination. Indeed, you are the indestructible nectar of immortality. Purport by Disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Sridhar Swami explains how the various terms of this verse demonstrate that the transcendental body of Lord Krishna is free from the characteristics of material bodies. All material bodies go through six phases: birth, growth, maturity, reproduction, decline and destruction. But Lord Krishna does not take material birth, since He is the original reality, a fact clearly indicated here by the word Adhya, original. We take our material birth within a particular material atmosphere, in material bodies that are amalgamations of various material elements. Since Lord Krishna existed long before the creation of any material atmosphere or element, there is no question of material birth for His transcendental body. Similarly, the word Purana, meaning full and complete, refutes the concept that Lord Krishna could grow, since He is ever existing in fullness. When one's material body becomes mature, one can no longer enjoy as in youth. But the word Ajashra Sukaha, enjoying unobstructed happiness, indicate that Lord Krishna's body never reaches so-called middle age, since it is always full of spiritual youthful bliss. The word Akshara, undiminishing, refutes the possibility that Lord Krishna's body grows old or declines. And the word Amrita, immortal, negates the possibility of death. In other words, Lord Krishna's transcendental body is free from the transformations of material bodies. The Lord does, however, create innumerable worlds and expands Himself as innumerable living entities. But the Lord's so-called reproduction is completely spiritual and does not take place at a certain phase of bodily existence. Rather, it constitutes the Lord's eternal proclivity to expand His spiritual bliss and glories. As the Lord states in Shruti, Purvam evaham ihasam, I alone existed in the beginning. Therefore here the Lord is called Purusha Purana, the primeval enjoyer. The original Purusha expands Himself as a super soul and enters every living being, since He is ultimately the absolute truth, Krishna, as stated in the Gopal Dapani Upanishad. Yasakshat Parabrahmeti Govindam Sachidananda Vigraham Vrindavana Sura Buruha Talasinam. The Absolute Truth Himself is Govinda, who has an eternal form of bliss and knowledge, and who is sitting beneath the shady desire trees of Vrindavan. This Absolute Truth is beyond material ignorance and even beyond ordinary spiritual knowledge, as stated in the same Gopal Tapani Shruti. Vidya Vidya Bhayam Binna. Thus, in many ways, the supremacy of Lord Krishna has been established in the Vedic literatures, and it is here confirmed by Lord Brahma Himself, Krishna. This particular verse is in continuation with Lord Brahmaji's prayers to Lord Krishna. what I visualized when I read this translation and purport was that this is actually a description of a perfect hero. You know, you might see in some movies where there is a big, you know, fire explosion and a kind of catastrophe, and from the middle of the fire, the hero walks out, you know, unharmed, nothing happened, not even a scratch. So this is very much what Brahmaji is depicting, how Krishna is, you know, in all these words, Adya, original, Akshara, Purna, Ajasra Sukha, and so many terms that Brahmaji is using to describe our hero. So Krishna's leelas are not subjugated to material limitations. They are ananta, unlimited without any restriction. The Atma, the soul, is an eternal part and parcel of Krishna. And the Atma is also as unlimited as Krishna himself. But when the Atma is put into this material world, the Atma experiences a culture shock. Just imagine a person who is not used to any limitations, having limitations. His own life is a limitation, you know. One time, there were two very, very rich boys, and they wanted to experience what poverty is. And they did a research, and they realized that that on an average, the poverty-stricken Indian population, the kind of food that they eat and the kind of place they stay in, average they spend about 32 rupees a day, you know. And these two boys, they decided, let's live like this for a few months and see. Living on 32 rupees a day, that means breakfast, lunch and dinner, and staying, travel, everything included, you know, in 32 rupees. And they tried doing it for 2 months. And after 2 months, they realized what it actually means to be in poverty. When they came back home, they started living normal lives. And when they would waste something, they would calculate. If this much piece of bread is wasted, that means how much it converts into rupees, you know. It could probably feed one person's breakfast, you know. So it became very calculative and understanding. So the point I'm trying to make is that if a very rich person is told you have to only enjoy this much wealth a day, it's a limitation for that rich man. Similarly, the Atma is just like Krishna, unlimited. But the Atma is put into a culture where it has to experience limited enjoyment and limited joy. So the Atma is really not used to darkness. One of the qualities of in the spiritual world is that there is no sun, there is no external source of light, because everything is self-illuminating. Krishna is self-illuminating. Similarly, the devotees of the Lord, even the Atmas in the spiritual world, they are Satchidananda Vigraha. The sun indicates knowledge. Similarly, Chit element indicates knowledge. And because there is complete knowledge in every soul, there is no need of an external source of light to illuminate. The soul itself is self-illuminating. So, when that soul comes into the material world, where he has to experience unlimited darkness, that's a limitation for the soul. And the soul is quite frustrated. Just like in this particular case, there's an interaction between Krishna, the Supreme Lord, and Brahma, a limited soul. Of course, comparing the different souls, Brahma is almost like an unlimited soul. But still, from the Krishna's point of view, Brahmaji is a limited soul. Just like a father who is a very, very rich man, he comes to a child. And the child shows a father, you know, he's like, you know, putting blocks together, his pink block, white block, yellow block, and he's making a building. And he tells the father, "Daddy, daddy, see, I've made a building." The daddy, if he is peaceful, then he will say, "Wow, very nice building." But if he's a little irritated, he will say, "What nonsense? I created you, and the building in which you're staying, in which you're building this building, is created by me." So the father, he has created the child who has the ability to make a small building. And so the father, he's not impressed by the child's small building that he's building. So here, Brahmaji is recognizing the fact that Krishna is the father. And he's telling, "My dear Lord, you are the one who has built everything. And inside that, I am building 14 planetary systems, which are like, you know, these blocks, which I am putting. So I know that you will not be impressed. So Brahmaji is praying to the Lord. Krishna, why do we say Krishna is unlimited, ananta, inconceivable? The reason is because Krishna can do anything. And whatever Krishna does can be explained with one word, achintya, inconceivable, you know. So some of the amazing things and inconceivable things that Krishna does, Krishna, he condenses the entire night of Brahma. And Brahmaji's night, 12 hours of Brahma, is like billions and billions of years compared to the earth calculations. When Krishna does the Ras Leela, he condenses the entire night of Brahma, billions and billions of years, into 12 hours. Now, for people like us, it is inconceivable. But actually Krishna does that. Now, how he does that is something we will never understand. That's why it's called as inconceivable. Krishna, in Dwaraka, if you visit Dwaraka even now, it's a small place, a small island. And within Dwaraka, he created thousands of palaces. Just the family of Krishna, Krishna had 10 sons from each wife, and each of them had 10 grandsons, and each of them had, you know, so many other grandsons, like that. Just the family of Krishna itself is millions of people. And beyond the family, you know, if a king has a family, he needs, each family member needs thousands of people to take care of that one person, you know. So billions of people living in that one small island, and we never hear of any traffic jams, you know, where chariots are stuck together, two horses are banging each other because there's no space to move around, you know. It's inconceivable how Krishna does that. And, you know, when Krishna takes his cows for herding, he himself has 9 lakh cows, and each of the cowherd boys of Krishna has lakhs and lakhs of cows. When they take all these lakhs of cows, I was just trying to imagine, between lakhs of cows, one cowherd boy, what will he control, you know? I mean, which cow will he control? If you go to our Goshala in Wada, just 20 cows, they come and start, you know, banging you from all sides, and you're trying to pat one cow, the other cow comes and puts his head. So it's very difficult to manage few cows. And here are 9 lakh cows, each cow wanting the love of Krishna as much as the other. And Krishna wanting to love every cow as much as the other. Just imagine, Krishna wants to pat every cow on its back. 9 lakh cows, it might take him a few days to even pat the 9 lakh cows, right? And just imagine Krishna taking these 9 lakh cows to drink water in Yamuna River. Just to make them drink water, it might take a whole day. But Krishna, he does that in a few minutes. Inconceivable, again, you know. When Yashodamai, we hear this Damodar Leela, you know, two fingers too short, all the ropes in Vrindavan falling two fingers too short, is just inconceivable. I mean, even if you try in the wildest imaginations, if probably somebody, you know, makes a cartoon of, you know, trying to bind thousands and thousands of ropes, it's just not possible to make any movie out of it. When the gopis of Vrindavan, when they see Krishna, they curse Brahmaji, you know, the culprit here, the victim here, you know. They curse Brahmaji that he had made eyelids that blink. And for them, one moment of separation from Krishna is equivalent to 12 years. So what Krishna is doing is, within that one moment of blinking of the gopis' eyes, Krishna is fitting in 12 years. Inconceivable. One moment, you blink your eye and open your eye, 12 years are gone. You know, that's the kind of feeling that the gopis have when they miss Krishna for that one moment. So basically, understanding Krishna is impossible, and appreciating Krishna's inconceivableness, that also is impossible for us. But with whatever limitation we have, we can a little bit touch upon the inconceivable nature of Krishna. When Shivas Thakur was having a conversation with Swarup Damodar, Shivas Thakur was telling Swarup Damodar how, you know, this is more to understand the glory of Vrindavan. He was telling Swarup Damodar, what is your Vrindavan? Your Vrindavan is nothing but little dust here and there, and few trees and few cows. And compared to Vaikuntha, my Lakshmi Devi is staying in Vaikuntha. Vaikuntha is an opulent place, unlimited riches, unlimited opulence, so much wealth, so much opulences. Saur Damodar explains to him, Vrindavan is not just a land that you see which is filled with little dust and cows and trees. Each grain of sand in Vrindavan is Chintamani. Each tree in Vrindavan is Kalpavriksha tree. Each cow in Vrindavan is a Surabhi cow. And he was telling how the opulence of Vrindavan, when you compare it to the opulence of Vaikuntha, Vaikuntha is insignificant compared to the opulence of Vrindavan. And here, Brahmaji, he has not even experienced Vaikuntha. He has experienced his Brahmaloka, Satyaloka, which itself is quite opulent. But when you compare Satyaloka's opulence with the opulence of Vrindavan, he is falling short somewhere. When he saw that, you know, unlimited four-armed forms of the Lord, Brahmaji realizes, whatever I have seen so far, just imagine what kind of mysticism Brahmaji is experiencing, you know. Little mysticism of this world can bewilder us a lot, you know. Somebody producing a little ash, or somebody taking out gold, or somebody doing any small insignificant thing can really impress us. What kind of mysticism Brahmaji is seeing? Brahmaji is even above Tapalok. You know, Tapalok is a place where all the mystics, you know, the great sages reside. He is above all of that. That means, being above all of that means he is seeing all of that. So, Brahmaji is not impressed with mysticism. You cannot impress Brahmaji by showing a little magic, taking out gold or, you know, taking out a little here and that. Brahmaji has seen all the mystics possible. But if Brahmaji is bewildered by what Krishna has shown here, that means the mysticism that Krishna has shown is beyond what any living entity can conceive of. That's the nature of Vrindavan. And here, the amazing part is that Krishna is not even acting like a mystic. He's acting like a small boy. To act like a mystic, generally when you come across mystics, they are quite arrogant and they are quite proud of their mysticism. They carry an air around them, being a mystic. But Krishna is not even carrying that air around him. That bewilders Brahmaji even more, right? And the question is, this consciousness of the Vrajavasis in Vrindavan, how do you gain that consciousness? It's not that you gain that consciousness of being residents of Vrindavan automatically. One time, Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami, this famous story of how Rupa Goswami once decides to do something for Sanatana Goswami, because Rupa Goswami was considered his elder brother, Sanatana Goswami as his spiritual master. And Rupa Goswami wanted to make some sweets for Sanatana Goswami because it was his appearance day, it was his birthday. And Rupa Goswami, they were beggars, they had nothing, you know. So Rupa Goswami was contemplating, I want to make something for Sanatana, I want to make something for my Gurudev. And when he was contemplating like this, a small boy, he came and he said that, I know that you want to make something nice for your spiritual master, for Sanatana Goswami. Here, take some sweet rice. You can offer this. So Rupa Goswami, you know, without understanding, he just took that sweet rice and offered it to Sanatana Goswami. And both of them, when they drank that sweet rice, they started rolling on the ground. They started exhibiting ecstatic symptoms. And they realized that something is wrong here. Something is wonderfully wrong. And, you know, then Sanatana Goswami asked him, who gave you this sweet rice? You're a beggar. You have nothing. How did you get this? And then Rupa Goswami explained that actually a small girl came and gave this sweet rice. And then Sanatana Goswami asked him to describe who that girl is, how the girl looked, and what she said. And Rupa Goswami explained the whole description of every feature of this girl. The devotees are like photo cameras, you know, just especially when they see the Lord in their deity forms, in their amazingly beautiful forms, they just note every aspect of the Lord and his consorts. And Rupa Goswami, when he explained, Sanatana Goswami started chastising him. He said, come on, we are supposed to be in Vrindavan serving Krishna. And Radharani is the mistress of Vrindavan. And you are taking service from them. So then Rupa Goswami realized he made a mistake. But the essence of this story is that, how is Vrindavan revealed to us? Vrindavan is revealed to us when we have a desire to serve our spiritual master. Krishna is revealed to us when we have the desire to serve our spiritual master. And Vrindavan, it cannot be revealed by just seeing. It has to be revealed by an experiential way. And the spiritual master, when you serve the spiritual master actually gives you the mercy by which you can experience Vrindavan. Seeing Vrindavan is not so big, but experiencing Vrindavan is really big. Therefore, somebody was telling this amazing concept of how a lotus survives in water. The lotus has two sources of nourishment. One is the sun on top of it, which actually gives nourishment to the lotus. But if the sun is on top, very hot, the lotus is nourished. But the sun, only the sun is not enough. Below the lotus, there has to be water. Just imagine, if the water gets dry and only the sun on top is there, that sun can be dangerous to the lotus. So the lotus actually withers away and dies. So if you actually want to experience spiritual happiness, then we need both. The sun on top of is Lord Krishna, and the water below is the spiritual master's mercy. So only when the spiritual master's mercy is there in abundance will the grace of the Lord make sense to us. And here, Vrindavan is revealed when there is a combination of the two. Spiritual master's grace and the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And Brahmaji here, he wanted to experience Vrindavan. He wanted to experience, the whole understanding in a way which was not in the mood of service, but in the mood of testing. So one needs to be in the mood of service to actually experience Krishna nicely. The body of Krishna, one of the aspects in this purport, Prabhupada is saying, is that the body of Krishna is actually free from material characteristics. And in the section in Srimad Bhagavatam where this marriage of Krishna and Rukmini takes place, before that there is this wonderful pastime where Krishna is running away from Jarasandha. Before that, Krishna actually killed Kalayavan and comes back. And when he comes back, the whole Yavana army of Kalayavan is there. He kills all of them. And he's taking all the loot, the gold and all the jewels inside Dwaraka. That time the second army comes. Jarasandha comes with his 23 armies and attacks Krishna. And Krishna and Balramji, they both run away. Of course, just immediately after that particular pastime, there is a description, one verse which says, Balramji got married to Revati. And after that, the whole chapter description was Krishna marrying Rukmini. So the Acharyas explained that Krishna and Balaram had better things to do than fight with Jarasandha. They had to marry their consorts. So they ran away. And in this running away, there's an amazing understanding. When Krishna and Balaram run away, and Jarasandha is following with his whole army, and Krishna climbs this mountain called Paravarsana. And this mountain is 11 yojanas in height, 90 miles in height. So before climbing the mountain, it's explained that Krishna and Balaram are exhausted, tired of running. Just imagine, they have already ran so much to kill Kalayavan. Krishna takes him running to inside some cave way up in the north, And after that he comes back and again he starts running when Jarasandha comes, So it's quite a lot of running. After all this running, it is explained that Krishna and Balaram are both tired. And immediately the next verse says, they climbed up the mountain, which is 11 yojanas in height. How can a person who is tired, exhausted, climb up a mountain which is 11 yojanas height and jump from the top of the mountain? It's impossible for any normal human being. Therefore, Prabhupada, in the conclusion of that particular section, he says, seen without envy or quarrelsomeness, the pastimes of the Lord are immensely entertaining. If you don't see it from an envious perspective or an argumentative perspective, how is it possible? They are tired. How can they climb? How can they jump from top of the mountain, which is 11 yojanas and 90 miles in height? If you don't see it from that perspective, the pastimes of the Lord are extremely entertaining. But more than that, if you see it from the perspective that Krishna's body is non-material, then the pastimes are also enlightening. Because they tell us who Krishna is. Brahmaji, his problem at this point of time, why he was analyzing Krishna, because Brahmaji was surrounded by people who were smaller than him. In the sense that, in life also, if somebody wants to really progress, do something wonderful, grow in one's spiritual life or even in one's material life, it depends on what kind of people you surround yourself with. Most people, due to insecurity, surround themselves with people who are inferior to them, so that they can command them, they can demand respect, and they can actually manipulate them. But intelligent people who really want to grow in their life, they surround themselves with people who are better than them, so that some point of time they can be corrected. So that some point of time they can feel that I need to grow. So when you are surrounded with people who are lesser than you, you don't feel the need to grow because you are the biggest. But when you surround yourself with people who are smaller or who are much bigger than you, then you feel yourself to be insignificant and you want to grow from your little shell, you know. So Brahmaji, at this point of time, because he was constantly surrounding himself with people who are inferior to him, lesser than him, he was the hero. But when you surround yourself with people who are better than you, then you seek heroes. So when you look for heroes around you and you follow them, then you grow in your personal lives also. And one thing why people don't prefer to surround themselves by people who are better than them is because people hate criticism. People hate, you know, being taught. People hate being educated. They feel they know everything. So Brahmaji, at this point of time, he was in that position where he was thinking that I know everything. I am the creator of the 14 planetary systems. I know everything. I know every speck of grain in this whole 14 planetary systems. But only when Brahmaji came in face to face with Krishna, somebody who was bigger than him, he realized, I don't know anything. And that's why he starts praying like this, right? All these words that Brahmaji is using to describe Krishna just indicate the fact that he is associated with somebody bigger than him. So association with somebody bigger than us can help us grow spiritually and even materially. So whenever a devotee falls in trouble, he knows where to go back. You know, just like this wonderful example of how, when I go to the school, I see these children playing with balls, you know, but there's one particular type of ball where there's an elastic band to it, you know, and you throw the ball hits the ground and bounces back to your hand, you know. So devotees are like this bouncing ball, you know, with a rubber band attached, the elastic thread attached to it. So when you're thrown into this world, when you hit the ground, you learn to bounce back. But a materialist is like a clay ball. When you throw and it hits the ground, it bursts, right? You just kind of gets destroyed. So the devotee of the Lord, the moment he makes a mistake, he realizes that I need to bounce back to Krishna. So Brahmaji here, he's acting like this bouncing ball. He's just been thrown, made a big blunder, he's hit the ground. What is the meaning of hitting the ground? Hitting the ground means falling in trouble, right? Brahmaji has fallen in great trouble. But he knows the only way out of this trouble is let me bounce back. And he bounced back immediately to his original position as a servant of Krishna. So when we ascend into the material world, most people take a tour of the material world to experience becoming a swami, becoming a master, becoming a controller. But when you hit the material world, you understand, my God, there are too many controllers. Everybody wants to be a controller. That is the time when you actually realize this, then you decide, let me bounce back and take shelter of somebody who is really in control, you know, take shelter of the Supreme Lord. This world, the sense gratification of this world is a very illusory type of sense gratification. You know, just like there was a crow who was sitting on a dead body, you know, this dead body was thrown into a river, and this crow was sitting on the dead body and, you know, pecking and eating pieces of flesh from the dead body. And this crow got so much absorbed in the dead body that he just forgot what was happening around. So his dead body was floating in the river. It was going slowly, slowly, slowly. And he went into the ocean. And the dead body reached the middle of the ocean. And the crow, after such a long time, he woke up to see what was around him. And then he realized that he's no more in the river, but he's in the middle of the ocean. He can't fly away from there. It's too far. And very soon, this dead body is going to vanish. Right? It's going to be eaten by fishes. It's just going to vanish. So, coming to the material world is very much like this. The river is like time. And the ocean is like death. And the dead body is like the different sense gratificatory, you know, appeals of this world. And we are like that crow, sitting on the different sense gratificatory appeals, trying to enjoy, forgetting that the river of time is going to take us towards the depth of the ocean. And when we reach there, we realize, my God, it's too late. I can't come back also now. So therefore, one should be ready to, you know, to focus. Just like somebody was telling me that, you know, the time of death is so tough to face. Unless you're prepared, you can't face it. Just like if a man doesn't know how to shoot, you know, how to take a proper aim and shoot, he's not practiced enough. Just imagine he has a gun in his hand and a tiger jumps on him. Now, at that time, he can't make a proper aim. You know, just imagine a tiger is jumping on you and you don't know how to shoot properly. You can't say, hey, let me try, you know. You just will not make it. So similarly, if you're not practiced enough chanting, if you're not practiced enough spiritual remembrance of Krishna, time of death is like a pouncing of a tiger. At that time, you can't say, let me try. Maybe, you know, tukka, it might hit the target, you know. No guarantee. You might just get destroyed. So one has to practice enough. And the biggest obstacle for us to practice is the feeling that I am the controller, the feeling that I am the enjoyer, the feeling that I am the proprietor. So here Brahmaji is saying, I am not the controller, I am not the enjoyer, I am not the proprietor. What is he doing? He is constantly reminding himself of the reality. Being an illusion is very easy, but coming to reality requires remembrance, constant preparation. So Brahmaji is practicing. I made one mistake, I don't want to do it again. I'm repeating again and again and again. So some of these prayers look very repetitive. But unless we keep repeating the same thing again and again, how are we going to remember it at the time when the tiger jumps on us? So the experiences of sense enjoyment in this world is like, the sense enjoyment is like hot ghee. And you pour it into cold water, it is naturally going to blast. So combination of sense enjoyment and Krishna consciousness is not going to work. It will create a blast, you know. It'll create an explosion. So therefore, one needs to be very careful and seek how one should actually take shelter of Krishna through the process of prayers. So here, we are seeing the prayers of Lord Brahma, and I want to discuss one more aspect of Sharanagati, of how surrender is so important, from a little concepts from the other scriptures also. So when does philosophy work? Philosophy works only when guilt comes in our heart. If there is no guilt in the heart, philosophy doesn't work only. You know, just like Dhritarashtra, when Vidura was telling him so many times in his life, all his life Vidura was telling him, don't do it. Surrender to Krishna. Don't, you know, challenge the Pandavas. Don't go against Dharma. Dhritarashtra could never understand. Only when he went through the guilt of being responsible for the death of his 100 sons, Vidura's words made sense to him. So Vidura was trying to awaken the feeling of guilt in Dhritarashtra's heart all his life, but through philosophy. But the philosophy didn't work unless there was a practical experiential learning. So many times, like just here, Brahmaji, he knew that Krishna is God. At least theoretically he knew. But he wanted to experience how Krishna is God. And therefore, he instigated him, you know, trying to do something which will really test Krishna to the limit. So Dhritarashtra also, he technically knew Krishna is God. But he couldn't really accept it till he saw the death of his 100 sons. Yeah, after that he realized, the Pandavas are alive, all my sons are dead. Not even one of the Pandavas is missing. Then he kind of realized, maybe Krishna is God. And then Vidura's words really pushed him to the limit till he understood. So basically, what prayers does is that it helps you overcome your lower nature. You know, just like when somebody is very guilty, in the newspapers we see so many times, you know, these photos coming of criminals who are caught and they put a mask on their face. You know, except the face you can see. I just don't understand why they put these photos, you know. It just doesn't make sense. You can't recognize any of them. But the photos are there in the newspapers. Why do people cover their faces? Because there is a solid feeling of guilt in the heart when you do something wrong. So, but when Krishna does something wrong, apparently there's no feeling of guilt in the heart. Now Krishna, he robs, right? But you don't find Krishna's, you know, makanchor leela with a face covered. Krishna is smiling, you know, when he's robbing, right? Krishna running away from the battlefield. You don't find Krishna covering his face and running away. Krishna is proud of running away. Krishna dancing with the gopis, he's not shy. He's not thinking that, you know, what if the world comes to know, you know. He just doesn't care because the guilt doesn't come in the heart because there is purity. And when there is guilt in the heart, immediately it shows that there is some impurity, impure element in one's actions. So Dhritarashtra, he spent his whole life and he was trying to make his life secure. And Vidura, through his prayers, through his words, he was actually shaking up the security of Vidura, the security of Dhritarashtra in everything material. So Vidura was trying to tell Dhritarashtra that the only security is in taking shelter of Krishna. And Dhritarashtra was trying to prove that the only security is taking shelter of power. Finally, Vidura won. So this need of security is there in everybody's life. You know, Brahmaji at this point of time here, when he's making these prayers, he wanted to be sure that this boy is God. He wanted to be sure. Because, why he wanted to be sure? Because he is the supreme demigod, the controller, creator, master of everything in the material world. If he is going to take shelter of this boy, he wanted to be doubly sure that this boy is God. Therefore, that feeling of insecurity led Brahmaji to make this whole, you know, Brahma Vimohan Leela happened. So similarly, the sense of insecurity is there in everybody's heart. Thinking that material resources, material sense gratification is going to give me security. Dhritarashtra tried it in a very gross way. All of us try it in very different, maybe not so big ways, but in smaller ways. So because the insecurity feeling is there that what if Krishna cannot protect me? What if Krishna cannot nourish me? What if Krishna cannot deliver me? That insecurity feeling is there in the heart. So unless this insecurity feeling goes away and confidence arises that yes, Krishna is the one who can give me security, then we will not be able to handle. So therefore, Vidura comes in Dhritarashtra's life to show him. What does Vidura represent? Vidura represents spiritual master who is fully confident of Krishna's security. Vidura has no doubt. Maybe, maybe not. You know, conditioned soul has doubt. Maybe the process works, maybe it doesn't work. But why does the conditioned soul need to take shelter of a spiritual master? Because spiritual master has no doubt. So sometimes in this world, taking shelter of somebody who is fully confident is needed to go one step ahead. Forget spiritual life, even materially also, you know, when somebody is working on a project and there is a leader who has a vision and there are people who are not able to see that vision. The leader is saying, come on, we'll be able to achieve this. The followers are saying, it's too big to achieve. We can't handle it. The leader is saying, don't worry, just follow me. I'm going ahead. Just seeing the confidence of the leader, these people, the followers just follow. They have no faith in the goal, but they have faith that this guy knows something, right? So spiritual master is that kind of a leader for us. And Vidura is acting like that kind of a leader for Dhritarashtra, showing him, I know what I'm speaking. I know where I'm going. Just follow me. Prabhupada, what a confidence he had. You know, most people admire Prabhupada not so much for the philosophy, but for his confidence. One person whose confidence was unlimitedly strong, people just couldn't understand why he was so confident. And sometimes, even devotees doubt, how can Prabhupada be so confident? So that kind of confidence is a hope for us, actually. So when Narada Muni, his mother died. The moment his mother died, Narada Muni, he said, my shelter is God now. And he walked out. He didn't even try to ask people of the village for shelter. He just walked off because the Bhaktivedantas, when they were there before, they had told him that the greatest shelter in life is not your mother. The greatest shelter in life is not wealth, not security, not anything else except Krishna. And that was etched in the heart of Narada Muni. And the moment his mother died, the only apparent shelter that Narada Muni had, he said, now is the time to take real shelter. He walked off. Gajendra, He simply accepted God as a creator. And he just took shelter of God in a way which he knew from his previous life. A child, when he is feeling insecure, the insecurity of the child may be for the want of food, for the want of, you know, a hug, for the want of, you know, sense of protection, so many things. The child, when he's feeling insecure, he doesn't go on Google and search, you know, what do I take shelter of, you know. The child knows spontaneously the only thing I can take shelter of is the mother. Starts crying, right? And the moment the child experiences the mother's shelter, he's happy. Similarly, prayers are a tool to take shelter of God. And Brahmaji is very similarly showing us that when you are insecure, pray. And that prayer cannot be a very mechanical prayer. It has to be a very intense prayer. One time there was a man who died, and he went to the to the abode of the Lord. And from top, he was looking at the material world. And he saw a temple. I don't know if it was a Hare Krishna temple, but he saw a temple. And he saw people were dancing, people were, you know, shouting something. But he could hear no voice, you know. People were dancing, and it was like, you know, I mean, it very clearly showed that they were shouting, they were screaming, they were singing. So he asked God that, why I can't hear anything? So God, he told him that unless people sing with intensity, you can't hear anything here. You can see the actions. You can see them, you know, really showing the enthusiasm, but you can't hear anything. So even if you don't have to be loud for it, but you have to be intense. So when prayer is done in an intense mood, it may not be loud, but it is done in an intense mood of the heart, then Krishna wants to hear us. So another aspect of the scriptures where this understanding of intensity of taking shelter is there is in the Ramayana, where Vibhishan, he has left the security of his home, Ravan's kingdom, you know. That's supposed to be the place where there's unlimited gold, unlimited opulences, unlimited, you know, resources. And he is an inside man there, you know, in Ravan's kingdom, because he's a brother of Ravan. Being an inside man, he was secure. So Vibhishan, when he realized that Ravan cannot promise me security for forever, he said, I have to go to Lord Ram to take shelter. So going to Ram means actually going towards insecurity from Vibhishan's perspective, you know. No guarantee he's going to give shelter. No, he doesn't have any resources. He's a beggar himself. And how is a beggar going to give shelter to another beggar, right? And he's an enemy more than anything else. How is an enemy going to give shelter to another enemy? No guarantee he'll give. And once he walks out of the kingdom of Ravan, there's no guarantee Ravan will take him back. You know, dobi ka kutta, na ghar ka, na ghat ka, you know. That was Vibhishan's status. But Vibhishan said, if I need shelter, I cannot depend on any other shelter. Now, in our initial days of Krishna consciousness, we always hear this analogy of these two boats, the material boat and the spiritual boat. They're going parallel. But only problem is they're going, you know, in two different directions. So how long will you keep your legs on both the boats? So, you know, because keeping legs on both the boats is quite a secure feeling. I'm a little material also, a little spiritual also. So I'm not too much gone here. I'm not too much left this also. So that feeling of security is there in most people, where they say, I don't want to take intense shelter of spirituality, because what if it goes wrong? What if I don't make it? At least I need to keep one leg on this boat. So Vibhishan was in that status. Should I leave this? Should I take this? And he knew the place was too far away, 100 yojanas far. So he cannot keep his leg on both boats probably, right? He knew, I need to decide which boat to take shelter of. And the prerequisite for one to actually take shelter of God are two things. One is that one has to understand one's inability to achieve the result through any other way. And the second is that one has to completely depend on God's mercy. These are the two prerequisites for somebody to actually take shelter of God. Unless I realize that there is no other way than this, I will not take shelter. I will not have confidence. And unless I realize that unless God's mercy comes, there is no way I can take shelter. These are the two prerequisites. Just like if a small child has to climb an elephant, what it has to do? Now, the elephant is too big, too huge to climb. The child cannot say, you know, I mean, he cannot try probably climbing the elephant. unless the elephant bends down and keeps his knee, and the child and the father pushes the child up, you know, and the mohurt on top is trying to pull the child up, the child possibly cannot climb the elephant on its back. So similarly, going to the spiritual world is like climbing top of the elephant, you know, by a small child. First of all, the spiritual master has to push from below. One step. On top of that, the Lord, who is like a huge gigantic elephant, has to take one step below, bend a little bit. So spiritual master is pushing from below, Lord is bending from top, and the child is doing nothing. He's just standing over there, you know. The only thing the child has done is that he has taken helpless shelter of the father and of the mohurt on top of the elephant. Because if the elephant does one whack, the child is gone, he's dead. And the father does one mistake, the child is dead. So the helplessness of the child is very similar to the helplessness of a spiritual sadhaka, of a seeker. And unless that situation comes in life, you really cannot take shelter. So when Vibhishan came to Ram, he folded his hands. You know, there are two concepts that are explained in the Ramayana. One is akinchanatvam. Akinchanatvam means, I don't possess anything. Vibhishan came with nothing, practically. He had only one mace, one gada, nothing else. He just came with nothing. And second thing is that ananyagatim. Ananyagatim means, he said, I can't go anywhere else. Because he has already left Ravan. He can't go back to Ravan definitely. And other than Ram, he doesn't know anybody else to go to. So these two are prerequisites for one to actually take shelter of God. And Vibhishan, he showed that he is akinchan. That means he doesn't possess anything by folding his hands. When you fold your hands, you know, this is the mudra of Sharanagati. When you fold your hands, you're actually saying, my dear Lord, I don't possess anything. And he folded his legs also. When you offer obeisance, sometimes you see in South Indian temples, you know, people fold their legs. And I many times wondered, what do they fold their legs for? The folding of the legs indicates, my legs are tied. I cannot go anywhere else. If you tie your legs, you can't walk, right? Similarly, when you tie your legs, you're indicating to Lord, my dear Lord, this is the place I am going to live and die. I have no other place to go, right? And only when you do these two, then Krishna is ready to give you shelter. Therefore, when Lord Ram sees the mood of Vibhishan, Ram asks Sugriva and all the monkeys, should I give him shelter or no? Now, you know, the monkeys, they really don't know too much the mood of the Lord. They tell him so many things, you know, come on, how can you give him shelter? You know, you cannot give him because he's an enemy. And he is, you know, Sugriva is telling him that he has deserted his brother, how can you give him shelter? Ram is looking at Sugriva. He also deserted his brother, and he's talking about deserting brother. So Ram killed Vali, Sugriva made him kill Vali. So Ram, the point that Ram was trying to make was that he told two stories. I'll tell one of the stories. He spoke the story of a bird, two birds who are sitting on top of a tree, and a hunter comes. And the hunter kills one of the birds, the female bird. And the male bird is so much in agony and anxiety. And the hunter, you know, after a few days, he comes under the same tree. And it's raining, it's very cold, the hunter is shivering, he's hungry. And the bird, he realizes the hunter has come. But the bird realizes this hunter is taking shelter of my tree. He's taking shelter of me. I need to help him. So the bird collects firewood and makes a fire for the hunter to stay warm. And the bird realizes the hunter is hungry. So the bird jumps into the fire and roasts itself for the hunter. You know. So Lord Ram tells his story to Sugriv and he tells him that this bird gave up his life to give shelter to this hunter. And if I don't give shelter to Vibhishan who has come to me, then I am lower than this bird. So if I have to give shelter, you know. So ISKCON is an organization where ISKCON is a program of prayer. Srila Prabhupada, the way he has organized the society is that morning filled with prayers, the Mangal Aarti, Tulsi Aarti, Narasingha Aarti, you know, then Guru Puja, all these are prayers for taking shelter of the Lord and the spiritual master. And again in the evening, Gaur Aarti and, you know, Kirtans. Each prayer, the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, the holy name, is again taking shelter of the Lord. And when we experience, many of us, you know, many times when we practice spirituality, sometimes we feel that maybe I'm experiencing a little taste. I'm experiencing a little bliss. Maybe the very reason that we're still there in Krishna consciousness is because somebody is praying for us. And because of those prayers, there is great hope for us. And therefore, the ability to pray, you know, whatever prayers we do, is also the mercy of the Lord only. It's not that, you know, we have a special ability built in us. When Dhruva Maharaj, he went to Lord, when we saw the Supreme Lord in front of him, he didn't know, he couldn't speak. He couldn't speak a word. And when the Lord touched him with the conch, so many prayers came out. And those prayers that Dhruva Maharaj prayed, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was listening to those prayers hundreds of times. Now, it's not that it's Dhruva's prayers. It is Dhruva's prayers which were inspired by the Lord, and the Lord is listening to it. So it's quite amazing that it's not that the prayer is special because you're praying it. The prayer is special because you're taking shelter. The Lord is empowering you to pray. So, both ways. So, Brahmaji over here at this point of time in his life, he is praying to the Lord. So many qualities of the Lord he's analyzing. All those prayers are just indicating the mood that I am insignificant and you are significant. And when we take shelter of the Lord in such a way, then when the tiger comes and jumps on us, then we will be able to shoot. And if we don't take shelter of the Lord in this way constantly, when the tiger jumps, we'll be fumbling with the gun. You know, we'll not know where to shoot. Hare Krishna. It's already late. We'll not take any questions. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.